Welcome to Week to Week, the political roundtable from the Commonwealth Club of California for Tuesday, October 6, 2015. This, of course, was the week in which Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina told Fox News that she herself is, quote, distinctly horrifying to liberals, unquote. She said it herself. So thank you for joining us here today in San Francisco. We will try not to distinctly horrify anybody. I'm John Zipperer, your host for Week to Week, and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On today's program, we're going to talk about the presidential election campaign, naturally. We're also going to look at this new Hoover survey, into Golden State residents' views about the drought, water policy, who's at fault, what we can do. We'll also go in depth on President Obama as he nears the end of his seventh year in the White House. And, of course, we'll talk about some other political news. Naturally, the Commonwealth Club of California is a place for people of a very wide range of views, so any opinions that are expressed up here tonight are those only of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club of California, unless I agree with them, in which case I'll take full credit. Let's meet our panelists for today, and I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Carson Bruno. He is a Hoover Institution Research Fellow. Next to him is Bruce Kane. He is the director of Stanford University's Bill Lane Center for the American West. And next to me is Bill Whalen, another Hoover Institution research fellow. If you noticed a bit of a pattern here tonight, it is a Hoover and Stanford night. But don't worry, because Bruce also works at UC Berkeley. So we've got everyone covered. So it's going to be a good program. Please use the question cards that are spread throughout the room to ask any questions. We'll collect them, and I will try to read as many as possible during the program. So now on to the roundtable, and let's start off with this research result of Hoover. I can't speak tonight. Now, each quarter, Hoover's Golden State poll asks California residents their views on state matters, and this quarter, the topic was the drought and water policy. So, Bill, lay the groundwork for us with this poll.
You can find the full results at the Hoover website, which is hoover.org. We asked, in addition to water policy questions, we asked Californians to list what they think is the priority for state government to be addressing at this time. Usually, as long as we've been doing this poll, the economy leads this issue. It's address the economy, strengthen the economy. This time, it was the drought. Plain and simple. So I think this shows that Californians have pretty much this in common, a lot of skin in the game. The results, I'll let Bruce and Carson get into the finer details of the poll, but a few carries away from it. First of all, there is a lot of what I'd call good Samaritan aspects to this poll. Californians are willing to conserve. Californians are willing to share their groundwater supplies. Californians are looking for action. So it's, in all, a very positive finding. But you look deeper into the poll and you find that there are some divisions among Californians, how exactly to go forward, divisions which divide people in terms of geography, in terms of partisan affiliation, in terms of, in some cases, age and gender, which Carson Bruce will explain. But the timing we just felt was important because here we are in the fall of 2015. Maybe it rains this winter, maybe it doesn't, maybe El Nino comes along, and if we're lucky enough to have it this far north, perhaps it replenishes our Sierra water pack. If we're lucky, perhaps it helps fill up our reservoirs, but it leads to another set of water policy issues related to 2016 to go forward. So this is simply why we did the drought. We wanted to see what Californians were interested in. We wanted to see what, if any, divide there was between Californians and get a measure for what they wanted moving forward.
Maybe Bruce, why don't you give us some highlights from the results? What stood out the most to you? What was perhaps the most surprising?
If you watched and followed the newspapers, you would see that there were some potential landmines for the governor when he went forward with his proclamation on the drought and the policies that he implemented. For example, a lot of people in Southern California are upset that the baseline by which the cuts for different areas were determined was 2013, because in Southern California, they had confronted droughts before and they had taken more steps than we had in Northern California to conserve water. And in fact, down in Southern California, the per capita use of water has gone down, so that even though that area has grown, they're not per capita using more water. So taking 2013 punishes the cities that didn't start before. But our poll indicated that people were willing to go along with it. Yes, there was some regional difference, but it wasn't really great. The governor also, I think, has endorsed an all of the above strategy. That is to say, if you listen to the partisan warfare about water, you would think that we were very divided as to whether or not we should build more reservoirs and more dams or whether we should go for aquifers and recycling water. In reality, what we found is that the public that we surveyed was in favor of all of these things, as the governor's strategy was in favor of all of these things. And indeed, the voters in supporting, I think it was Proposition 1 or 1A, they ended up, you may not have known it, but when you voted for that, you were voting for reservoirs and dams as well as water reclamation projects. So I think what we found was that the governor has been on pretty solid ground in terms of what he's done so far. But the reality is that what we've done so far is the easy stuff, okay? And what we're facing is potentially a bigger, deeper problem for two reasons. One, it's quite possible that the water system we built was during a period of relative wetness. So independent of climate change, if you look back at the cycles of drought in California historically, you see that we might have been, when we built our water infrastructure system, in a relatively wet period, and we may be in a drier period just naturally. And then you add the fact that with climate change, there is temperature change that is making the snow line recede. And as a result, the system that we built, which stores water up in the mountains and brings it down by gravity, which saves us a lot of power and energy expense, that system is being undermined systematically. And it's not clear that if we have to maintain the current level of cuts or if we have to go deeper, that we're going to find the level of public support.
I think the people I see in the audience kind of fanning themselves are not going to argue that it's getting yeah. warmer. Carson, get a bit into some of these numbers now. What are some of the divisions we see? What are some of the actual results that people told you, guys, about how they feel and what should be done?
Well, I think Bruce really touched on this well, in that Californians really aren't pointing their finger at any one group area in general when it comes to you do need to be doing more when it comes to kind of fixing the water situation, which is actually kind of rare given the fact that this is kind of a crisis, and during times of crisis people tend to kind of point to the other person saying, oh, it's not my fault, it's their fault. But what we're finding in these numbers are that Californians really want the state to be throwing the entire kitchen sink at this problem. And whether it's environmental, whether it's agriculture, whether it's municipalities, they all need to be doing their part in kind of addressing the very structural deficiencies that this drought is exposing in how our water system is designed. And Bruce touched on this really nicely also, that Sacramento needs to start thinking of the current situation as the new normal. Even if it isn't the new normal, it should be thinking like that, because that's how you get real structural fundamental reforms through a what's somewhat dysfunctional Sacramento. So just to kind of touch on some of the numbers, you know, it's interesting. We asked a bunch of policies that affect water use and also a bunch of policies that affect water supply. And you see clear either majorities or pluralities on focusing on every single one of our water use policies. You know, from restricting groundwater use at 67% of likely voters, all the way down to, as Bruce mentioned, requiring the reductions, the conservation mandate, to be set at that 2013 benchmark. That's at 45% amongst likely voters, but that's still a plurality amongst the sample. If you go to the policies that affect water supply, everything from building reservoirs at 70%, to collecting and treating stormwater for potential use at 91%, and even some things that might be a little bit more controversial, such as relaxing environmental laws to help aid the construction of new dams and reservoirs, a majority at 53%.
I'm going to guess on that one there was a party difference.
There is, yeah. That one is where you really see kind of regional effects coming into play, and also partisan effects. You know, while 53% say, yeah, let's go do it, let's relax those environmental laws, only 36% of the Democrats sampled said such. Now, Republicans, of course, at 76%, and self-identified independents at our majority at 55%. Also, when you look at the regional composition for relaxing environmental laws, here in the Bay Area, it was actually effectively split, 41 support, 41 oppose, whereas in both Central Valley and Southern California, there was majority support there. And the other one, interesting, that's a little bit more controversial, and again, we didn't go into kind of giving arguments for or against any of these issues, but another interesting one was building more desalination plants along the coastline. And there, 82% of likely voters, including 77% of Bay Area likely voters. So you definitely see a lot of consensus here in kind of the policies to attack the drought problem from both angles, the use of water, but also trying to build more supply, more resources. That is more of a long-term issue, not necessarily a more immediate focus.
Well, let's all kind of get into the politics then of that. So Californians are basically saying, a lot of these options, yes, we like all of these options. I don't know if you went into this, or do you have a sense of when price tags start to get attached to that? You know, will you pay higher taxes to build a desalination plant and to whatever? Any sense of the price tag affecting those numbers?
We didn't push that as well as we should have. We didn't have enough questions for that. But I think one thing that's pretty clear is that currently, we did ask about subsidies, and one of the real problems with water prices is that you have people that have rights that go back to the early 20th century that get priority for surface water. You have situations where farmers are getting the water in the Imperial Valley for $150 an hour per acre foot. They're selling it to the city of San Diego for $1,000 per acre foot, and then desal costs you $2,100 per acre foot. So when you put those price tags on, you realize that one thing that's happening is we're not pricing water in an efficient way. And we kind of bury, when it comes to electricity, we pretty much kind of understand that there are peak rates and peak times, and we've sort of gone there. Where when it comes to water, water's treated as kind of a public free good, and the reality is it isn't a free good. You have to be transported long distances. It requires a lot of energy to get over the Tehachapi Mountains and send it down there. If we build these tunnels, we're talking about billions of dollars and more infrastructure payment. The reality is that infrastructure cost is buried in a lot of bond measures. So when you approve these bond measures, you do have to pay off those bonds. It's not free money. But it's like credit card spending. America is addicted to that. It takes you away from the immediate choice of whether you want more water or not, because you're not actually paying the price right now. It's being fobbed off onto the future. So I do believe that the pricing part is part of it. The other thing that was interesting, and Carson didn't quite mention it, but we did two experiments that I think fall under the rubric that if you give people more information, their views may change, and hence they may change on pricing as well. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we did an experiment on basically what share of the water now goes to agriculture. And if you give people no information and you say, are you interested in or are you open to the idea of reallocating water from agriculture to urban and industrial use, you see a majority of people that say, no, let the farmers have their water. If you tell them that 80% of water used by humans is used by agriculture, you flip that around and you get a majority in favor of taking a look at that, including a number of Republicans. Republicans are almost split down the middle on that issue. Okay? If you change it to a different statistic, which is, you'll see in the papers, which is the total water in California, not just the water that's used by humans, then you find that it's 40% for agriculture and it's 50% that either flows out to the environment or is used for fish in the bay, and only 10% goes to. And you get slightly different, still get close to a majority support. So information will matter a lot, and if we go further into this, I think as people get more information, their views may change about desal as opposed to reallocation.
And something else we pushed on is the issue of recycled wastewater. which is moving along in Orange County. Los Angeles County, which, as you can imagine, has an enormous water system, is also having preliminary conversations about how to implement this as well. And we asked a series of questions in the poll, and we asked people without knowledge of how recycled wastewater works, would you be comfortable with the following uses with recycled wastewater? When you ask Californians, are they okay with using it to water their lawns, to wash their cars, to water their trees, they think it's a great idea. But when you bring in the issue of human contact, do you want to bathe in it? Do you want to cook with it? Do you want to drink with it? In fact, let's poll the crowd here. How many of you would be comfortable having a nice cold glass right now of recycled wastewater? Okay, it's really hot in here. That's what it tells you. I think in our poll question was what, about 10%?
With no information provided, and again, this was an experiment, so we provided one of the contingents got no information, one got a little bit of information about how Orange County does their wastewater recycling, which is by far the most advanced and the most aggressive, I think, in the world. And then another third of the sample got even more detailed scientific details about how Orange County does theirs. When you get no information at all, 10% say, yes, I'd be willing to drink that recycled wastewater. Now, it does double to 20% once you get the detailed information, but you're not going to, I doubt you're ever going to find a majority saying, yeah, let's drink this wastewater.
And where this gets tricky is it's not a matter of Republicans hate it and Democrats love it or vice versa. We saw splits along the lines of gender.
Yeah.
And we saw splits along the line of age. So put yourself in the position of the marketing people in these water districts. You have to sell this concept to people and think about what kind of public relations campaign you're going to come up to sell this to, a public which at first glance is kind of leery about the concept. Maybe come 2016 or 2017, there's going to be Jerry Brown holding up a nice glass of water saying, recycled wastewater, yum.
Yeah, you did that with malathion.
Yes.
Women are much less willing to bathe, drink wastewater, recycled wastewater, and younger people are more willing to do it. So men and younger people are more adventurous, even after you give them information. And I will let you guys sort that out yourselves.
I was
talk
say,
to your partners about that, and we'll see. Okay.
It's also interesting. So of the personal uses, and I classify the personal uses as drinking, cooking, bathing, filling your swimming pool because you get contact there, and then washing your clothes. As more information is provided, the filling your swimming pool and washing your clothes does get into majority of individuals saying that, yes, I'd be willing to use the recycled wastewater for that purpose.
Right.
And as Bruce mentioned, younger individuals and males tend to be a little bit more likely. Interesting enough, though, the Bay Area is less likely when across the board to use it for those more personal issues. That was an interesting tidbit that I pulled out because the Bay Area has been, in many other cases, a strong leader in pushing recycling in general.
And in some places, using it for agriculture actually is controversial, although in Californians we didn't see that in the poll. But I used to tease David Kennedy, who was my predecessor, with the Bill Lane Center for the West, because what he does regularly is he takes his shower water and he saves it and he waters his avocado trees with this, and then he serves it to us at our dinner at the end. So, we leave it at that.
Well, when you talk about the broad acceptance that this is, people mentioning this is the number one issue in the state. It's not the economy, which you say it usually is. That suggests to me, because this is something that is affecting people now. It's not like it's a theoretical thing, Therefore, that kind of tells me the messaging has gotten out. Is there any connection, do you think, they're making with Jerry Brown has been effective at this, or whoever has been, whether it's our local utilities that have been pushing messages about conservation and such?
Yeah, actually, I got an undergraduate to collect a lot of the information about the different approaches that the water districts were taking, and I thought we would be able to assess which were the best practices, but it turned out that there was no relationship whatsoever. In other words, that tells you it's not whether you did tiered pricing or whether you had mandatory days when you couldn't water or any of the other specific measures. It seems to be a cultural acceptance across the board of people that we're in an emergency situation, which is good news. It means that this country or this state is able to come together when under a crisis. The bad news is that if we have the El Nino that some people are predicting, and if indeed it drifts far enough north, then we're back into the situation that when it rains temporarily, people will go back to their old, the pressure to go back to old habits is going to come back again. And the reason to worry about that is that even if you have a couple good years of rain, what the scientists are telling you is that you have a long-term structural problem in terms of the system that you have. And if we're going to have a sustained approach to this, if we're going to solve that problem in a permanent way, we have to look to the trend, not just to the yearly cycles. And that's a real problem that might come about if we end up having flooding and have enormous amounts of rain.
So if you were either a lawmaker in Sacramento or you're advising a lawmaker in Sacramento, you used to work with the governor, Pete Wilson, what would you want, what could you take away from this that you can actually do something with? Because you do have this moment in time where people are focused on it, they recognize it, they're saying great things about what they want to do with it. What would be some good moves for Sacramento to make?
I would task my Department of Fish and Game, my Department of Resources, every state department and agency that is involved in some way with flooding and disaster relief to give me a report on how prepared we are in case the Russian River floods, in case rivers in Central Valley and Monterey and others which stream out to the sea in which they flood. Have we cleared debris? Are our levees in sound shape? If you look at countries, states across America which have had droughts not as bad as California, but dry spells, it rains like crazy, and guess what? You find that your levees have been very weakened over this dry period. So I would just have preparation reports for my people, maybe give a talk about it to a water agency, bring reporters in and just talk about the fact that we're watching this, we're ready to respond if something happens. But just show that publicly I'm aware that a little bit of rain is not going to solve our problems.
Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. But I think the real problem is this long-term problem of a sustainable water policy. And right now what we have is a land use policy which is out of control. And no matter what we do in terms of recycling or clever ways of finding more water, it's going to take us forever to build these dams and reservoirs, by the way. But we can't keep up with an unrestricted demand for water. And you have areas like the Coachella Valley which are building golf courses. They have 121 golf courses down there. They have man-made lakes, okay? So you have profligate use of water because it's subsidized in some areas. So we don't have an efficient water pricing. That has to change. We have to look very carefully at whether the land use is linked to a water budget. And it's not just, I don't want to pick on Southern California and Coachella Valley.
You're in Northern California, go ahead.
In Northern California, we have the same problem, exactly. And let's not forget that there's a farming component to this, too, that we've allowed for crops that are permanent and can't be made fallow for a year because we now have high-value crops that have trees that have to get watered from year to year. There's no restriction on the building of these orchards, and they're depleting the groundwater supply. We had basically a system where, okay, when the surface water wasn't there, people would pump the groundwater. Well, guess what? We're getting tremendous land subsidence in areas of the Central Valley. So land use policy has to be right at the forefront. We can't, you have to say to a region, you should take a basin in a region, you should say to it, look, you got a water budget. This is how much water you have right now. If you want to build more residences, or if you want to go ahead and put more orchards in, tell us where you're going to get your water. Tell us what your plan is. Where are you going to generate that water? And if you're counting on water from the State Water Project, or if you're counting on water from the Colorado River, where there are growing communities in Las Vegas and Colorado and elsewhere, then you may be making bad assumptions that aren't going to, and we're not going to bail you out. If you don't have the water for that, you're going to have to suffer the consequences. I think that's the most important thing.
Okay. Now, if I put a solar roof on my house, I get tax benefits, correct?
Yes, you do.
If I drop-proof my house in some way, if I change the landscape, if I put in a rock garden or cacti, do I get a tax benefit?
You don't get a tax benefit. In some communities, you do get rebates or rewards of some sort, but it's not a systematic policy.
Right.
But that's it is true. This is a good point, Bill, that if you think of the strategies, we need to do the conservation strategy first because that's the cheapest strategy. The most expensive strategy is the desal strategy, okay? It's alluring because you have all that water out there that actually could be used. But it turns out that to get the salt out of that water takes an enormous amount of energy to push it through the membranes. And then when you're done, you have this residual brine that you have to put somewhere and you have to disperse it out to the ocean. And if you don't do that properly, it can create dead zones. So the reality is, the cheapest thing we can do and the most important thing we can do right from the start is have a really strong conservation strategy that sustains itself beyond the El Nino. And that's where the land use policy can be helpful, I think.
Okay. Carson, your prescriptions for Sacramento.
I would say this. We've asked now this top priority question in quite a few of our Golden State polls. The first time we did it was back in January 2014. Back then, only 38% of Californians, this was registered Californians at that point, said that dealing with California's water problems was the top priority for Sacramento to deal with. Fast forward now to September, and this is among likely voters, but still, the jump is quite miraculous. 81% now say that that is the top priority for Sacramento. Surpassing strengthening the economy for the first time, surpassing a lot of other issues that Californians historically want Sacramento to be on top of all the time. You can also track this explosion in the in this question of the top priority with how much of the state is under an extreme or exceptional drought. Back in December or January 2014, roughly, I believe it was 6%, 7% of the state's land mass, you know, that's roughly 7 million-ish people, were living in areas of extreme or exceptional drought, the top two criteria or categories of drought. And fast forward to today, you're now looking at basically 95% of the population, and basically 77% or so of the state's land mass. So this is a crisis. It is a crisis that people are now dealing with up and down the state, from coastal to inland, agricultural municipalities, the environmentalists and the activists who have to deal with this issue. And so, you know, as Winston Churchill said, you know, never let a good crisis go to waste. This is an excellent... It was a Robert. Winston Churchill gets credit for it quite a bit, also. So someone stole it from someone else. Anyway, someone said, "Never let a good crisis go to waste." This is an excellent opportunity for Sacramento to really get every single stakeholder at the table to make real long-term decisions, because you know whether an El Nino actually does affect the water levels in the reservoir or the snowpack in the Sierra or not, it is going to change how Californians think about the drought. And at that point, then, Jerry Brown and many other legislative leaders will have kind of lost, I believe, an opportunity to really try to hammer through a very long-term structural change to how California does water. And we only... you have a little while left to, I believe, to make that happen. So
good point.
I'm not going to give the time.
Right.
Yeah. Value I'm not going to give you know, prescription because I think Bruce and Bill have done it quite well, but the time, the clock is ticking. It needs to be done.
Well, before we move on to another topic, I wanted to ask you folks again a question. So Governor Jerry Brown, when he was first starting to try to get people to realize the seriousness of this, noted that he was taking fewer showers. So can I ask you, by a show of hands, how many of you have cut back on showering or bathing? Well, it's maybe half. How many of you want Jerry Brown to start showering again? We've got a few hands. Okay, very good, very good. Well, let's discuss the latest in the eternal 2016 presidential campaign. A lot has been going on. I actually want to start with New York Magazine, if any of you are familiar with it. Frank Rich writes the cover story for the current issue that's out on the stands. He argues that Donald Trump is good for democracy despite, or actually because, of his trumpery, his outrageousness. He says Trump is pointing out this corrupt charade of our democracy that it's become. Bill, do you have anything to respond to that? Do you think there's an upside to Trump?
I think Frank Rich wants to live in Trump Towers is what it sounds like. Arnold Schwarzenegger ran in the recall, and part of the promise of Arnold was he was going to rejuvenate democracy in California. In 2010, we had the lowest turnout ever for a gubernatorial election, so I'm not sure that I would point to Trump as a tonic for all things. I'm afraid I just take the opposite view. Donald Trump is ultimately vulgar, and he just represents a vulgarity that goes through our society, and it's crude comments that people say on Twitter, and indeed Trump is guilty of recklessly tweeting late at night. It's the fear of, I have a godson who I am always afraid of taking to sporting events because of the crude language you hear at a sporting event. It's just the very coarse fabric in society where people just don't act with a lot of dignity and decorum. And unfortunately, those are the people who he's appealing to in this election, and I don't see that as a positive for democracy.
Bruce, does it hurt democracy? Please.
Well, I think there's something deeper than Trump's popularity going on here that I don't think we completely understand, but we have some notions about. You can't help but notice that both the Democratic and Republican Party right now have variants of populism growing up on one wing versus the other. The one on the Democratic Party is a more traditional kind of populism. Bernie is kind of a man of the people, railing against, rightly, tremendous increases in inequality that have come into our society. And that's the traditional way that the traditional form of populism, a man of the people up against the elites, the financial elites that are taking advantage of the system. The one that's a little strange is the one on the Republican side, because here you have basically the logic, it takes a billionaire to take care of the billionaires, right? Which is something that we don't see quite as much of. We saw a little bit earlier in 1992 with Ross Perot. You maybe have some parallels in Italy with the Berlusconi phenomena. But it does strike me as a rejection of two things. It's a rejection of the style of conventional politics that has developed as a result of the professionalization of politics in America, where people are coached to say pretty much the same thing. The party line goes out to everybody. Everybody repeats the party line. There's no real information given.
Everything's audience tested.
Yeah, audience tested, poll tested, and So I think somebody that actually sounds like your uncle, your drunk uncle at the dinner table, is refreshing, I guess, to some people. But I also think underneath that there is this kind of malaise that the Democratic and Republican Party represent certain classes of the upper middle and beyond. In the Democratic side, Hillary really represents, to be honest, the professional class. The lawyers and other members of the sort of white creative class, so to speak. And the Republican Party has the mainstream, business class. And I think that left out is are people that are more on the fringes of the economy, one way or the other. And the Republican Party has pulled some of them into its ranks over the years with Pat Buchanan and with the sort of
the God and
the
guns.
Social issues, the God and guns. And the Democratic Party still has particularly the minority working class disadvantage. So I think there is a deeper phenomenon under this that may play out in ways that are unusual that we haven't seen in our lifetime. In terms of how the November election plays out, it's just hard to say. But I think it's not just about Donald Trump. There's something else going on there.
Carson, do you want to defend Trump, or are we going to go three for three here?
No, you'll never hear me defending Trump. I will echo what Bruce was saying, though, that there is something definitely happening. I mean, it's not just Trump. If you look at Ben Carson's numbers, and you look at Carly Fiorina's numbers, The three, Trump, Carson, and Fiorina, are at or over 50% amongst all the polls.
On the Republicans.
On the Republican side, yes. The Democrats are a little bit different because Bernie's an outsider, but he's still part of the political class. I mean, he's been a senator for a long time, before that a congressman, before that a mayor. So, I mean, it's not like he is this outsider per se. He's been a part of Washington for a very long time. But still, there's that outsiderness to him that is very definitively anti-Clinton. What I'm actually most curious about is what's happening at the next tier down in the polling, especially on the Republican side. You know, who amongst the next group, that next cluster, that are all around the low double digits to high single digits, who's going to break out from there? Because that's the group that you really kind of see that a lot of the players eventually getting behind, the people who really make or break campaigns at the presidential level. You know, that's Jeb Bush, that's Marco Rubio, that's even Ted Cruz. He's, as much as he likes to call himself an outsider, he's still very much connected into the political network nationally. Who amongst them are going to be able ones to kind of break through the Trump Carson Fiorina crowd?
You mentioned Jeb Bush, and that Jeb Bush was assumed to be either the front runner or waiting to be the front runner as soon as Trump stumbled.
Right.
He's now at what, 4%? I mean, he's a margin of error.
It's fascinating. It truly is. Yes.
I mean, the story is the popularity of Dr. Carson and Trump and Carly Fiorina, the outsiders, but also the weakness of the expected standard.
I think there's a lot of miscalculation on the Bush campaign's part, but also I think everyone kind of got caught by surprise about what was happening. You saw it with Scott Walker, and you kind of see it with Rand Paul also. Rick Perry, another one, who dropped out. Rand Paul hasn't dropped out yet.
No, but Rand Paul has one
he's
of his.
Going,
super,
he's going that direction.
Yeah, one of his super PACs has just said we give up. I mean, literally.
But you can see the systematic kind of miscalculation amongst what the electorate is looking for, but also then how to run and appeal your campaign.
So I'll defend Trump.
Okay.
I think you cannot discount the possibility that Trump could be the nominee, and here's why. The way the rules in the Republican Party have been changed, he could easily, you move past the first few elections, start taking advantage of the winner-take-all rules. So like the Democrats, the Republicans have been futzing with their rules, going between these proportional rules, which keep people in the game longer, and the winner-take-all rules, which basically give all of the delegates to the person who wins, that whether they get a majority or not. And Trump's numbers have been between 25 and 30 pretty consistently, and it's entirely possible that the system will give him a growing share of these numbers. And the polling that I've seen indicates that over 80% of the Republicans said that they would support Trump if he was on the final ticket. So I think before you dismiss him as a marginal figure, I think you have to realize that it's entirely possible that some combination of the rules and some combination of party loyalty could actually produce Donald Trump as the candidate.
Now, what will be interesting will be if Trump, this is kind of ironic given that he's worth anywhere from what he claims $10 billion to $3, which others report, if he's willing to crack open his own piggy bank. He's spending money on flying his 757 around the country. He's hiring staff. He's doing polling. He has a campaign, but he's not spending money on advertising. You notice about 2 weeks ago, he got into yet another feud with Fox News. And this time he said, I'm not doing Fox News anymore. That lasted about 5 days. And I think he came to this conclusion. Much like Hurricane Joaquin running up the East Coast, he needs Fox News for warm water to refuel himself. If he doesn't go on Fox News, if he doesn't go on O'Reilly or Hannity or Greta and get what is essentially free national advertising, he's got to crack open his own piggy bank and start spending on his own advertising. And I just have a hunch. People who get as wealthy as Donald Trump, one of the reasons why they're that wealthy is because fundamentally they're cheap. So keep an eye to see. Jeb Bush is going to spend about $25 million, I think, shortly on advertising.
Yes.
I wish him luck. It's like trying to light a wet log, I think, frankly. let's see if Trump, as we move along in the primary process, once we get past the early states in February, once we get out into the wider spectrum, if he's willing to spend what it takes to get the nomination. Because that's, you know, if he's willing to spend $50 or $100 million to get the nomination, then yeah, watch out. Katie, bar the door.
The question is kind of when Iowans start really paying attention, and that doesn't really normally happen until you get really kind of close to the holidays,
right,
if not past the holidays. New Hampshireites, New Hampshireans, what are they called? I'm not even sure. Once they start paying attention, what starts happening? And you're starting to see the numbers, especially amongst not only Trump, but also Carson, starting to deflate. Not much, not a lot, but they are starting to deflate. And you're starting to see a Rubio surge. Now, is Rubio surging too soon? That could be the case. You know, could there be someone else in the wings? That could be the case. But for someone like a Rubio that has to go up against the Bush juggernaut, and the Bush's campaign, for all of what the flaws might be there, it's extraordinarily well-funded, extraordinarily well-organized. They have boots on the ground in basically every single early state plus some, and they have the money to be able to just hammer every single opponent. Stuff that really no one else right now in the field has currently. Trump has the money that he could put into the campaign.
And he's certainly free to hammer the other...
Oh, yes. Yeah, he has no qualms about that. Yeah. But he doesn't have the boots on the ground. He is very minimal and very non-professional people on the ground, quite honestly. He has people that he pulled from the Trump organization who know nothing about how Iowa works, how New Hampshire works, how South Carolina works, what these people are looking for, how to put on a political, in a caucus particularly, how to actually organize a caucus and get your people to the caucus location in the middle of an Iowa winter. I mean, it's not an easy thing. You know, a lot of people kind of push aside the organization that is required. And that will kill a lot of campaigns. And so start paying attention to kind of this, and I, again, this next group down, kind of how Rubio's doing in comparison to Bush or Cruz or Kasich maybe in some of the early states, because it's not going to be who comes out maybe first in some of these states. They'll be the eventual nominee, especially in this jumbled mess, but kind of who is the unexpected kind of winner of the game. Pulling a Bill Clinton of 1992.
I was just going to say, he was not first, but he really rode. He knew how to spin that third place result.
Expectations matter, especially in a situation like this, I think.
These guys are all pundits, so I think we should put them on the spot, right? And someone asked this, who do they think would be the nominees? So let's go down the line, start with you, Bill. Who do you think will get the nomination? I know it's early. It's too early, but we're going to do it.
This is Bruce Cain's great idea, so you go first.
I've actually announced this to the students, which really puts me on the line because they'll track me down all year if I'm wrong. But I think Marco Rubio is the one who's going to prevail. And the reason I think so is that he's a very good fundraiser. He's, I think, done well in the debates to date. And he is the only one, I think, of the three sort of establishment candidates, and I don't put Cruz in that category, I think that he's the one that could reach over and bring in the conservative candidates conservative voters to a greater degree. The one real problem for him was his foray into immigration reform. And that, I think Trump has made his life more difficult by making immigration a big issue. But immigration really always sort of flares up early in these nomination processes. And then when you actually look at it, it's not a number one issue for people.
But that was an area in the last debate where, if you saw it, Marco Rubio did push back on Trump on right. immigration yeah. and made a bit of a mark there, I think, in people's memories. Okay, Bill, you can't escape it any longer.
I'm going to be boring, actually. The answer is, I think, Rubio. In this regard, there are 15 Republicans running right now. If you subtract Rand Paul, who I think we all agree is just pretty much running on empty right now, and then you take away the four goobers who were debating in the first debate at the Reagan Library, you're now down to about 9 Republicans, who I break into 3 categories. There are the 3 outsiders who we've mentioned. That's Trump, Fiorina, and Carson. There are 3 candidates who excel at anger, and that is Huckabee and Chris Huckabee and Cruz and Chris Christie. These were all kind of railing against something at all times. And then there are three Republicans left who the party would look at and say, these three guys have a shot at winning a national election. That's Rubio, that's Bush, and that's John Kasich from Ohio. But of those three, I would take Rubio for two reasons. Number one, as Bruce mentioned, he is formidable at fundraising, has done well in debates. But secondly, Kasich and Bush are both saddled by Common Core, which I can tell you from having looked at focus groups and polling with Republican primary voters is just about the kiss of death with them. They hate Common Core. So I would argue that actually immigration is probably less of a burden for him to carry. The one interesting thing about Rubio, I'd note, by the way, he's 44 years old. He'll be 45 next year. You have to go back to 1856 and the first Republican nominee, the illustrious John C. Fremont from here in California. That's how long ago it was a California Republican was a Republican nominee. He was 40, I think 43 when he got the nomination. Republicans don't do youth. The Democrats do youth. They do Obama, Clinton, John Kennedy, all in their 40s. Republicans go for somebody in their 60s or 70s. This is up and down and down up in 2016. The Democrats have a nominee in waiting who will be 69 next year, and the Republicans could very well nominate somebody who will be 24 years younger. So, again, just a topsy-turvy election.
Okay, Carson?
I'll start with the easy one. I think it's going to be Hillary Clinton.
You're playing to the audience.
Okay, yeah. Exactly.
The Bernie poll, are we?
There's definitely vulnerabilities there. Even if Biden gets in, which Biden does pull more from Hillary than he does from Bernie Sanders, I just don't really see a path that Bernie can really kind of pull an Obama and knock off the Clinton machine in 2016. The difficult one, Republicans. I'm going to go along with my two colleagues up here. At this point, it does look like Rubio is the one that can pick up the pieces whenever people actually start to vote next year. He is the one that can kind of bridge that establishment outsider sort of gap that you see kind of brewing. He is a very talented campaigner, not just fundraising, but also just messaging. And I think his message is a lot fresher, but more optimistic. And optimism does play out better than fear or anger in the long run. And even with the RNC trying to shorten the calendar a little bit, this still is going to be, it's a long haul. It's not an easy trek by any measure. So I think he has kind of the qualities that would be able to help maintain this kind of rise that you're seeing right now in the polling.
Okay, so they all agree. How many of you agree that Marco Rubio is a likely Republican nominee? Some.
Who do
some.
You wish would be the
Republican? Well,
I'm not going to run down the list of all 15 folks. But
Well, try Trump anyway. How many people think Trump
will be? Anyone think Trump will be it? Any Trumpers?
One, two.
We do?
So is it Bush?
Do you want him to be, or are you... Okay. No, you can support Trump. That's your view. But she's emphatic. She doesn't. So, well, let's talk about the Democrats. And I'm going to posit something, which is Hillary Clinton's had some pretty rough weeks. I think she's had a pretty darn good week, one of which was a gift from Kevin McCarthy. We'll explain that in a moment. And the other is, for example, three recent polls showing her maintaining or even expanding her lead within her party. So let's start talking about Kevin McCarthy and go with you first, Bill.
Thank you.
He stepped in it, didn't he?
The new McCarthyism. So Kevin McCarthy is the House Majority Leader. He may very soon be the new House Speaker. He's a Californian. He's from Bakersfield, so we're in this very strange existence where we're about to have a second California House Speaker, which historically does not happen. But Speaker-to-be McCarthy did something which can best be described as somewhere between stupid and clinically stupid. And he went on Sean Hannity's show, and he was talking about...
That wasn't the stupid or clinically stupid.
Well, actually, that was part of the stupid thing.
Oh, okay.
He went on Sean Hannity's show, and he started talking about Hillary Clinton's sinking poll numbers. And he said, look at her sinking poll numbers. We started an investigation on her on Benghazi, and look what's happened to her poll numbers. And this is the proverbial speaking of drought. This is manna from heaven if you're a Democrat, because when your party and your nominee is being challenged in a congressional investigation, what's your default position? It's partisan. It's a witch hunt. You're just trying to character assassinate that person. Here is Speaker McCarthy giving you the soundbite, and indeed, if you turn on TV right now, there is already an advertisement to the effect of showing him saying those words. So you probably noticed, or if you haven't followed closely, Speaker Reed McCarthy has gone dark for the last several days. He has not talked since then. He has issued a statement saying that's not what he meant. He's been out privately fundraising and talking to Republicans in private. It's a very bad moment for him, and it raises this question. Kevin McCarthy, as recently as a decade ago, was just a Republican lawmaker from here in California, a state lawmaker, legislature, which is a very backbenching existence. He then got a remarkable fast track. He got elected to Congress. He quickly got himself into the number three position. Then Eric Cantor, the number two, got kicked out of office. He jumped up to number two, and now John Boehner is leaving a little unexpectedly early. He's going to be a Speaker of the House with precious few years in Congress. He is green, and as you saw from this soundbite, he may be prone to rookie mistakes, and if you're a conservative who's not too sure about him, this makes you very uneasy right now.
Bruce, the effects?
I think there was no question that it was a gift, but I think that it was also going to be a problem in the long run, stringing out the Benghazi and the email controversy. I think it's pretty clear at this point that the law was at best ambiguous, and probably she was right that she wasn't required at that time, even though many agencies were adopting the email policy. And I think a lot of the email policy was kept alive by the press that wanted to get some of the details of her personal life, and so they got stories out of it. But in reality, when you think about it, the email policy is something we're going to have to think through, because on the one hand, employers don't want you using your business email for personal stuff. And on the other hand, there's an expectation now that email is part of the work product that's going to be archived for history. And keeping these two things separate, my guess is that people don't do a very good job with that. I certainly don't. I use my Stanford email for personal business. My guess is that the difference here is that she's working in the area where there's classified stuff. And if there had been something that had come across her her email that had obviously been classified at the time and she knew it, then I think they've got her. But it's not clear to me that they've got that smoking gun yet. So to me, it wasn't clear that, also with the Benghazi, that there was ever... It seemed to me that they haven't really been able to show in any way, shape, or form that she made a decision or a choice that really was a mistake. So to me, the Benghazi thing was always more about rallying the Republican base to get the money and get the organization going to get, but it wasn't going to be a November election that was going to pull off any Democrats, and it wasn't obvious that it was explainable to the independent voters. To me, I didn't really think that that was going to be a November issue. I saw it more as a primary issue. But, you know, let's see how she does in this debate. I mean, the real question that we haven't talked about is what's Biden going to do, okay? Now, the polling, even with Biden in it, is showing that Hillary's got a lead of about, 10 to 20 points, depending upon, there are some states that she's losing. But basically, on the general polling, even with Biden in there, she's winning. So Biden knows that. And Biden knows that that Hillary's been given a gift, right? And Biden also knows there's a debate coming up. Now, people say, well, why doesn't he jump into the debate? Well, the smart thing to do is to wait and see how she does in the debate, right? And if she falters greatly in the debate, then Biden can say, okay, look, you've got somebody wounded by Benghazi and the email, and she didn't do very well in the debate. It makes sense for me to get in, even though my numbers right now are behind hers. But if she does fine in the debate, and remember that she was really a better debater than Obama was. Obama was better at speechifying, but in terms of debating, Hillary's pretty damn good. She's a smart cookie, and she's going to be well prepared. So the odds are, I think, that Biden's going to look at this, and unless there's a huge stumble, unless she makes a big mistake, I think Biden stays out. If that happens, then she has a really, really good month coming up. And, because if Biden doesn't go in, I don't think the Democratic Party is going to nominate a socialist, despite the best expectations and hope of the Republicans to my either side. I don't think that's going to happen, guys. We're not going to give you a gift like that. So the reality is that you know, I think a lot will hinge on this debate performance, and I think that's why Biden isn't in the debate. I think he wants, that's the last sign he's looking for that will tell him to go forward.
Carson, do you agree? No Biden?
I'll start off with this. I think the McCarthy issue is not going to matter whatsoever in the primary or the general election, to be honest. Voters tend not to make decisions based off of very process-oriented things, and the Benghazi committee is a process, and what McCarthy said is a process. That all it's going to do is kind of, you know, ignite the partisans on either side, but not really going to move the needle whatsoever.
Okay, but some people have raised the issue. This was not just them getting out on the Capitol front steps and holding a press conference and saying Hillary Clinton, grr. It was them using taxpayer money on...
I still don't think it's going to be a big enough
issue. It may not be an election issue, but couldn't it be a legal issue?
I mean, it could be, but you get even more process.
And, sure.
Again, all you're doing is just really kind of really igniting the passions amongst hardcore partisans on both sides. That said, I don't think Benghazi in general is the reason why Hillary's numbers have taken a hit of late. It's really more connected with the email situation than it is Benghazi. Benghazi's been going on forever. It's been going on since the 2012 election. And it played absolutely no role there. So the email situation is interesting. Yes, I would agree with Bruce in that it doesn't, at this point, seem like she's done anything legally wrong, and she's been making that case from day one. What I did was legally okay, within the rules. The problem with it is it's reinforcing a perception of the Clintons. The worst thing a politician can do is reinforce what is already a negative impression of his or her persona. Romney in 2012 kept on reinforcing this out-of-touchness that he didn't really care about the common person, the ordinary person. It really sunk him in the end because he could not make a good argument to broadening the electorate in which he had to do. The Clintons are notorious, dating back to well before they were in the White House, to their Arkansas days and the governor's mansion, of being always kind of out to benefit themselves. There's always been this kind of suspicion there, whether that's panned out legally or not. It's tend to work legally in their favor that they've never actually been actually found guilty of anything wrongdoing, but that suspicion still lingers. And what the email scandal does do is to reignite that suspicion and also to reinforce it. And it's reinforcing it among partisans, the Democratic partisans also. What you find is Quinnipiac asks a question about the honest, trustworthy issue. 32% say Clinton nationally is honest or trustworthy. Just two-thirds of Democrats say she is honest and trustworthy. That's not strong numbers for the Democratic front runner in the primary. That, I think, is really the underlying cause of a lot of apprehension for her candidacy, because it's something that can, if it does continue, and there's evidence that the email thing will drip for quite some time, especially because the State Department's only releasing batches of emails.
Though I have to say, before we move on, we want to catch some other stuff in here, but one of the emails that came out recently, I think would make people like her more. it is an email in which she's complaining about her difficulty in getting the White House phone operator to let her through because the phone operator is saying, "I don't believe you're Hillary Clinton." And so the operator said, "Can you tell me your phone number there?" And Hillary's like, "I don't know my phone number. I don't call myself, so I have to go around this other way."
Today where it showed an email where she said, "How are things going in basketball? Crazy Indiana poll." She thought the capital of Indiana is not Indianapolis, but Indiana poll. So, but John raises a point here in that, you know, there's actually, I think, kind of an easy fix for her campaign. She has to introduce a certain joyfulness to her campaign that hasn't been there so far, and this is tricky for her because her public demeanor is not to be joyful. She is defensive, and part of that's, I think, she's guarded, but also she's been through almost 25 very bruising years in the public spotlight. But she is doing something historic at the end of the day. She is probably on a course to become the nation's first woman nominee of a major party and she could become our first woman president. I think she needs to reintroduce this concept that she's part of a larger movement, and on a personal level, point out the fact that, yes, I'm at a point in my life where I'm a wife, I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother. This is my last campaign. It should be for her more of a celebration than the sort of dirge which it's been so far. Mm-hmm. It's hard for her to do this. She is not in the same position that Obama was in 2008, where Obama, in addition to being 20 years younger, also had a large historical tailwind to him and a real appetite for change. But I think she has to, in some way, introduce a more upbeat nature. And, you know, she was on Saturday Night Live this weekend, and I'm certainly not a Hillary Clinton fan, but I give her two thumbs up. She did a really, really good job on that, and she showed she can be funny and she could take a job. And a lot of little vignettes like that, I think, will just kind of help correct the ship.
Okay. Well, let's move on briefly before we get to the news quiz then. Let's talk about President Obama, year 7. Bill, where's he at? It's not the same Obama necessarily we're seeing now that we saw for the first 6 years. He seems to me to have kind of evolved in this lame duck period. But what do you think?
Well, the president's coming to this neighborhood on Friday afternoon. He is arriving at SFO at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. You do not want to be on 101 at that time. Or on city streets between that and Fleet Week. It's not going to be a pretty picture. And I saw that and I thought, you know, this is kind of an interesting time to look at the president's agenda in this regard. He has done things which this community will be forever grateful for. The fact alone that he's not George W. Bush gets him a free lunch here for forever. But look, Obamacare, his federal steps on same-sex marriage, various regulatory things he's done on the environment. He'll probably close Guantanamo between now and the end of his presidency. He'll come away with some talking points that'll make you happy. On the other hand, when it comes to income disparity, when it comes to race relations, what we see going on over Oakland, he's been a little missing in the action on that. And so it's a very kind of mixed blessing for him. And I'll be very curious to see how historians handled him. But also, I suspect he's created something of a vacuum within his own party. And this might explain, in part, the rise of Bernie Sanders, that while Obama has done things which make Democrats, core Democrats, very happy, there have been other areas of the concept of hope which have not materialized, and there are probably some Democrats out there hungering for more.
Bruce, what do you think about that?
I think there's probably some truth to that. I think there is still residual anger over the fact that the 2008 fiscal crisis led to Wall Street basically being bailed out and very few of them facing any real consequences. So I think there's still residual anger about that. I think also people don't completely understand the strategy that Obama has chosen for the last couple of years, which is a very rational strategy, which is to use executive action and authority to get what he can't get through the legislature. It actually is very consequential. He is the EPA's restrictions on greenhouse gases are having an effect in terms of coal-fired plants in this country. Today, I guess he's endorsed, or the government is subsidizing essentially a daycare program in D.C., which he sees as a kind of an exemplar of what might happen around the country. I think those strategies sometimes are underneath the radar as opposed to getting a big flashy bill where you can actually sign it. So I think there's probably a little bit of impatience with Obama that comes from not realizing how much is actually going on below the surface. But, you know, look, it's not easy to be a lame duck at any level of government in America. You basically, people write you off and start looking past you. He didn't help the situation by playing as much golf as he plays and seeing he's already a kind of detached, analytical, professorial type of person as opposed to the warm, natural politician that Bill Clinton was. So if you combine real detachment with kind of an innate detachment, it creates a problem, I think, in terms of public. But, you know, he did show some passion over the guns issue, and while he's been taken to task by many people in Washington for, you know, venting his anger, I think the reality is that that does resonate with a lot of people, particularly a lot of Democrats who look at the situation of what are now, we're now to 45 school shootings in the last year, including elementary schools and colleges. I think about that. And when I teach, if I have a large class, you never know. It only takes one person in the back to be mad, and boom, you're out of there. So, you know, I think it does resonate with people, and maybe that side of him will come through more. It's hard to say how he plans to spend.
And somewhat, one of our audience members asked that specifically. Do we think that he, in his final, year and a quarter or whatever, will move on gun control? And can he do anything? I mean, Carson, is that something you'd expect to see anything from
him? I think overall, what the Obama presidency has shown is relationships really do matter when you get into the White House. He, only being in the Senate for a short period of time, he didn't have very long-standing relationships on Capitol Hill. And as Bruce mentioned, he does have this aloofness to him that he never really actively tried to build relationships, even in a short time in the Senate, but also once he got into the White House. And I think that really stymied a lot of his ambitions with what he wanted to do with the office legislatively. And relationships is important, not just building across aisle relationships, which is important, but also within your own party. And there's numerous accounts of just how he had a very kind of frosty relationship at times with Harry Reid, with Nancy Pelosi and some other legislative leaders, congressional leaders. So I think that stopped a lot of his momentum going into the presidency, which then whenever the Republicans kind of took over a portion of the Capitol Hill and then the Senate later on, it just stopped it dead on, which has forced him to move into the executive
action. Think I'm going to take issue with you, Carson. I mean, I think that the reality is a lot got accomplished in the period from 2008 and 2010 from the point of view of the Democratic Party. And in fact, it I think is part of the anger that the Republicans have. I think it is true that his natural lack of political, warmth was a contributing factor. But the reality is that the Republican Party, winning in 2010, got it in their mind that they weren't going to give him any more concessions. And so the real reason that we haven't had anything done is we have divided government. And the way happened in America, and this is very important, is that there's a lot of evidence in political science of increasing polarization in the two parties. In other words, the parties have become more sordid. They're more homogeneously ideological. And so the conservatives that used to be in the Democratic Party have gone over to the Republican Party, and the liberal Republicans have disappeared. And so you basically have much more homogeneous parties. Now, when you have united government, which we had from 2008 to 2010, Obama was able to get a lot done, because you had much more discipline. You didn't have Southern conservatives obstructing things. But the other side of the coin is that when you have divided government, you're going to do less. So it exaggerates the features of the American political system. And it doesn't matter whether it's Obama or whether it's going to be a Republican president, Rubio. If he has a divided government situation, if he has a united government situation for 2 years, he may get an agenda that's quite impressive. But I'm going to predict right then that if the voters switch and make one of the houses a Democratic, you're going to get back into the same stalemate situation. And you can't blame the individual who's in the presidency for that. It has to do with the underlying dynamics that we have in this country right now.
I would echo, though, say that Bill Clinton was able to get a lot done in the years after 1994, not in 1994 to 96, but after he won re-election. He got some substantial stuff done with the Republicans in the House. Now, granted, yes, the partisan issue has evolved since then.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of evidence that divided governments actually achieve more than...
That was in an earlier period.
The
scholarship is correct.
I'm saying, in between 2008 and 2010, yes, we got Obamacare, we got Dodd-Frank, but we got nowhere on Guantanamo Bay. We got nowhere on really climate change action.
Yeah.
We got nowhere on gun control. We got nowhere on Patriot Act. You can list a bunch of the things that Obama made a very a very strong component core of his message that floundered. And you could say that, yeah, that could be because they spent so much time on
healthcare. No, but the Democratic Party was divided on a lot of those issues.
Yes,
you had the Democratic Party that was in fossil fuel states in the Midwest. They were opposed on climate change. You had gun control opponents. If you gun control splits the Democratic Party.
But okay. I'm saying if you have, if this is a hypothetical, but if he had spent some more time building those relationships, could we have seen some different things
on
happen?
The margin, it could have happened.
Okay, I'm going to give Bill final word before we go to the news quiz then.
So you asked about gun control. We watch too many movies in this country, and one movie which we watched was The American President. You might remember from a few years ago, Michael Douglas is the American President. I think Rob Reiner directed it, Aaron Sorkin wrote it. And Michael Douglas, there's a big stand-up scene at the end where he stands up in the White House and declares war on, I think, of the environment, guns. I forget what it is, but he says, I'm the president and this is happening. We've expected that from every president since, and I suspect people thought Barack Obama would be that guy. But Bruce mentioned how Democrats get divided on issues, and gun control is a good one to point out. We're in San Francisco, where the last gun shop just closed the other day.
Yes.
Let's go for cheap applause lines.
Yes.
We're in San Francisco, where Barack Obama got 83% of the vote twice. That's 20% more than he got in Cook County, Illinois.
And the other 17% thought he was too conservative. So
five out of six people in this county supported him. I'm surprised it's that low. The point is this. The president can stand up and talk about gun control, but then there's a very dramatic political problem that occurs. The Democrats want to get the Senate back in 2016. How do they do that? Go to the map. They need to carry Illinois. They need to carry, these are Republican-held states right now, Illinois, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. The gun issue does not exactly play in San Francisco the way it plays in those other states. So these are the calculations the president has to make. In a wonderful world, yes, presidents would stand up and they would make these dramatic pronouncements and everybody would follow, but presidents are political animals, and that's part of the calculation. And with the possible exception of maybe immigration, there are a few more complicated things for a president to deal with than guns.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there for this week. Let's move on to our news quiz. How many of you have never been to a week-to-week program before? Raise your hand. Okay, I'll briefly explain how we do the news quiz. I'm going to read a question. And if you think you know the answer, raise your hand. Don't just shout it out. Raise your hand. I'll call on you. Then you can shout it out. If you're correct, then my prize delivery person will deliver some Ghirardelli chocolate to you. Is Nancy here?
It hasn't melted.
It has not melted yet. So, okay. So the very first question. Actually, the very first question was about the gun store closing, so I'll skip that one. It'd be a little too easy right now. According to the Pentagon, who requested the deadly airstrike that hit a Doctors Without Borders site in Afghanistan? Sir, I saw you in first.
Afghan security.
Right, they said it was the Afghan forces. The gentleman in the green there. Very good. Here's a question that might sound a little inside the beltway, but to us it matters. Political journalist Carla Marinucci, you've seen her on a lot of week-to-week programs. She's leaving the San Francisco Chronicle. Where is she going? Did you see this? In the back there, ma'am. That's right, Politico. Very good. See, you people know the stuff.
It's too easy.
Yeah, raise your hand so she can see you. And let's find a more difficult one. He says, ask a math question. Here's a math question. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee is widely tipped to easily win re-election next month, despite being opposed by five other candidates. Can you name one of them? Sir.
Amy Weiss. Fernando Herrera.
Very good. No, you're right. Amy Weiss. We have a winner right here. Very good. Okay. Sports brings guys together. Sorry. Sexist but true. What NFL controversy do both Jeb Bush and Donald Trump agree about? Did you see this story? Back in the corner there. No. Sir. Very good. They both agreed that the Washington Redskins should keep their name. There's, of course, a controversy that they should change it. Jack Dorsey is returning as CEO of the company he founded. It's a local one. You already knew. Anticipate the lady right there. Twitter, that's right. And the sheriff in Oregon, who is in charge of the investigation of the recent school shooting there, he's under fire for something he tweeted a couple years ago. What did he post? And your hand was up.
absolutely opposed to any regulation about guns at all.
Specifically, what he's under fire for right now, it's probably a bad way to phrase it, but what he's being criticized for right now is something very controversial that, sir, I want...
He supports a conspiracy theory that the Newtown School massacre was staged by the government using actors.
That's right. He's, it's a conspiracy theory that says Sandy Hook shooting was faked by the government. Okay, just a couple more. So who disputed Kentucky County Clerk Kim Davis's claim that he met with her for 10 minutes and agreed with her? Right in the front, Pope Francis, that is correct. He did meet with her for 10 minutes, but the Vatican says he did not endorse her actions. And Nancy, how many more do we have in there?
Four.
We're going to do three more questions, and I'm going to steal the last one. So 33 people died aboard a ship that sank after it sailed into what? This is near the Bahamas. Give you another shot. Sorry? Well, that's probably technically correct, isn't it? I was going to say the Hurricane Joaquin, but it's the Bermuda Triangle as well, so I can't call you wrong. Okay. This Thursday, members of Congress will select what or whom? Sir. Sorry? The new Speaker of the House to replace John Boehner. That's right. And let's do one more. I don't know if you saw this story. Who attacked executives of Air France, actually ripping off their shirts before they were able to escape? Way in the back there in the corner. I saw your hand first. I'm sorry? That's right. Air France employees. Not good relationships there, I would say. Well, listen, thank you. We're going to have some more news quiz questions as well as a lot more to talk about on Wednesday, November 4th at noon right here in San Francisco. Thanks to our panel, Carson Bruno, Bruce Kane, and Bill Whalen. Thanks to all of you here in our audience, listening online and watching on TV. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.